good. They spun off the old publicly owned power utility into a private organization called Ontario Power Generation. And they spun off the distribution and transmission into another organization called Hydro One. And I know this is all very complicated. But it set the stage very well for the beginning of integration of renewable energy into our system. So the government changed over from a conservative government to a liberal government, and they immediately started looking into options for phasing out coal generation in the province and replacing it with cleaner sources. And they took a couple different kicks at the can, initially trying to just do a few very small projects with some direct subsidies, a couple of wind projects, and then eventually moving into a version of a standard offer program. So they set targets for closing down the coal-fired generation, and we're moving towards getting into renewable energy. But during this period, a number of small community-based renewable energy cooperatives tried to get going. And it's from those groups, these small renewable energy community-based groups, that a larger movement towards getting a full-scale renewable energy policy in place came from. So one of the earliest ones was a small co-op in Toronto that decided to put up their own wind tower, and they're called the Toronto Renewable Energy Cooperative. And they sold private shares and built a 750-kilowatt wind tower in downtown Toronto. I think it went up in 2006. And them and a couple of other organizations, they founded the Ontario Energy. This is a lot of acronyms and names for people, so I apologize. We can take care of some of this in questions later. But they formed the Ontario Sustainable Energy Association. And that group, with some help from a few government grants and some private money from industry groups, got together and started the Green Energy Act Alliance. So it was a very informal coalition of groups sort of interested in pushing a more European-style energy model in Ontario. And when the government started looking at a standard offer program, originally they started with net metering, actually. They started with a plan to let people do net metering and found that there was basically no pickup because the economics of it just don't work for things like solar and wind. At the local level. And so they started moving into what we call the RESOP program, which is basically just a request for proposals system where they would say we would like this many megawatts of capacity in wind, please, and this many megawatts of capacity in solar. Who can meet them at the lowest price? And then they would grant the project based on the lowest price. So we did that, and that program was actually quite successful. At the moment, most of the renewable energy capacity in Ontario was installed under that standard offer program. It was never a tax-based system. It was always an adder on top of, that was a purchase power agreement, individually tailored to each project based on the lowest cost.
Just to clarify, that's not the RESOP. The RESOP is a competitive bidding option. The standard offer is...
Yeah, sorry, I'm confusing those two things. The standard offer came...
before.
Was an idea that came out of that.
Okay.
And the standard offer actually didn't really get going. It basically evolved with the help of the Green Energy Act Alliance into the Modern Fit program.
Okay.
So what I'm trying to do is set the stage there for where the Green Energy Act Alliance really got going. So what happened is they back in 2007 or so, got very involved in actually putting together an actual campaign. So the initial work was getting the stakeholders on board, educating them about the possibilities. And a lot of that work revolved around discussing what was happening in Germany and Denmark at the time, and actually involved some of the people you may have met already, Paul Geip, the international feed and tariff expert, and Jose Echeverry, who's a professor here at York University, but had been hired on contract for one of our larger environmental groups called David Suzuki Foundation. And they put together a full campaign and pitched it to the various stakeholders. So we managed to get quite a large coalition of the major environmental groups in Canada. So in Canada, that's David Suzuki Foundation, World Wildlife Fund. Us, we are Environmental Defense, and several other smaller ones. We've got sat down with many of First Nations groups that had been interested in trying to get into renewable energy. Mm-hmm. And they formed a group called Aboriginals for Renewable Energy, mm-hmm. and they joined the coalition. We involved some of the more prominent academics. And through Environmental Defense, we have a partnership similar to that exists in the United States called the Blue-Green Alliance. So in Ontario, it's a partnership between us, an environmental group, and the steelworkers, mm-hmm. and they were very interested in participating initially. And their input actually led to quite a few different changes in the program, which I can get to later. For farmers, we approached some people we knew in the Ontario Federation of Agriculture, which is an umbrella organization representing farmers across the province. Mm-hmm. And they were very supportive, so they joined on as well. And we also included many, you know, the energy sector has many small consultants who work with communities on various energy projects, and we involved some of them as well. So that was the initial sort of coalition. Uh-huh. And the community power sector, as I mentioned before, the early community group-based organizations were very much involved in throughout the process. So anyway, we ran a full-scale campaign and managed to actually get quite a bit of interest from the energy minister of the time, George Smitherman. And one of the later pieces in the campaign was to actually arrange a tour for the minister and senior bureaucrats to tour around in Denmark and in Germany to see how their program worked, and just to see the rationale behind some of the key parts of a feed-in tariff program. So anyway, that's the basically how it happened. That led to the passing of an act called the Green Energy and Economy Act in 2009, which was sort of set the basis for all of this policy. And then from there they directed the OPA, the policy organization, to craft much more detailed feed-in tariff policy, which came through shortly after. So we have a very robust feed-in tariff that is very much based on the German EEG system, with a few changes. The labor ask, the big way that we involved labor in getting involved is they really wanted to see some sort of mechanism to drive manufacturing and job growth as part of the program. And I think this is one of the key features that actually interested the government in proceeding as well, because it wasn't just about renewable energy, although that's an excellent thing, but it also was a way to drive significant job growth. So we put in a phased-in domestic content rule for solar projects must reach by 2012, 60% domestic content for the total value of the project, and 50% for wind, which is being phased in.
By when?
2012.
By 2012, thank you.
So it was a phased in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we have sort of four main technology groups: is solar, PV, wind, small hydroelectric, and bioenergy. So that's biomass and biogas projects. And they all are, it's quite a complicated tariff schedule that lists different tariffs at different rates for each of them. So for the solar, wind, and biomass, biogas projects, they're 20-year contracts, 20-year guaranteed contracts at a fixed rate. Some of them have a discounted rate, so the price decreases over time. Solar doesn't. And for hydropower projects, they actually got a 40-year payback. And I'm the actual details of how they negotiated that is something I didn't participate in directly.
Okay.
But I imagine that the various, I understand the various industry groups were involved in helping to craft the policy.
I believe Paul told me at one time toward the end of the rulemaking there were about 1,600 participants. They had to go to webinars.
Yeah, they had quite an extensive public consultation process.
Yes.
Leading up to this. The design of the policy was took a very long time. We were waiting quite a while for the rules to be released.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing how many pieces are required to make something like this work. We were wondering, are they going to charge, you know, upfront fees? How much, you know, what's the application process? It's quite a complex process when you think about it. But the net result is a very, very transparent process. So everybody knows what the rate is. Everybody can calculate exactly how much money is flowing. And so it's very publicly available and transparent. And it's very good, obviously, for investors. We're trying to attract private investment entirely for the program. And so investors obviously like the certainty of a 20-year program. And they went through quite a bit of detail in trying to determine how much money it actually took very early in the program to install all of these technologies so that they could work out what a fair payback would be for investors. So they tried to set the tariff as well as they could for a 7 to 11% payback, depending on technology.
Do you know how they came up with that as a return on investment? Do you have any idea?
I really don't.
Okay.
I don't know exactly. I think they were trying to base it on norms in the investment industry and in comparable circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I think the trickiest part about it is actually the domestic content rule requiring manufacturers to source content locally is very difficult because at the time we had very little renewable energy industry in Ontario, particularly solar and wind. We had no or very few local producers. And so that was going to add quite a large upfront additional cost to projects. And so that's why a lot of people have sort of said Ontario's feed-in tariff policy has very generous rates initially. And I'd say that's true, and I'd say that's because they estimated it was a 10 to 15% upfront increase at least for solar and wind projects, given that we were requiring them to source content locally. And, of course, the idea of all of this is a longer-term creation of a renewable energy industry in Ontario. And the program is designed to be reviewed every 2 years. So we were going to sit down and actually immediately after our next provincial election in October, we're going to we're scheduled for a review of the program, and it's expected that the rates will be lowered based on the same sort of calculation they did before to figure out the cost of projects. And actually, at the moment, the solar and wind industries are actually calling for a reduction in the rates because they don't want to see the business overheat and then implode.
Okay.
There was some talk about that having happened in Spain under their feed-in tariff program, that they may have set the rates a bit high initially and had such a run on the program. The program is designed to be open-ended, to have a sort of an unlimited amount of capacity, theoretically. But, of course, the number one constraint we've faced, and it's actually proven to be more of a constraint than I think they initially planned, was the amount of distribution and transmission capacity on the grid is quite limited. And it's limited very geographically. So some areas of the province have, capacity to spare, and some areas people have applied for projects and not been accepted to the program because there's no more space on the grid for them.
Okay.
So I'm just trying to go through the questions that you put forward.
Thank you.
I got many, many excellent questions. We can maybe get to some of those in a second.
Okay.
So I guess in the short time, we've basically had the program up and running for 2 years, and there was one question I got was, how is this received by the public? I think what's really interesting is the public at large probably knows very little about energy policy on the whole, and the system we had for many, many years in Ontario was so simple. We just had coal power plants, nuclear power plants. That's where your electricity comes from. I'm not sure if very many people really understand photovoltaic or wind technology at all, and don't understand the economics and all of the complexity of it. So I think the one failure is that through all of this stakeholder consultation amongst stakeholders, the general public was largely left out of the discussion, and there wasn't much effort made in the early years of the program to educate the public at large about what the project is, what the feed-in tariff program is, why it exists and why it's important, and some basic education on some of the technologies themselves, like solar and particularly wind power, would have been very helpful, because at the moment we're actually facing quite a large backlash against the policy for wind power, just sort of a fear-based anti-wind campaign traveling across the province. And it's a growing sort of fear of the unknown, sort of a movement that has been spreading quite a bit of misinformation about wind. And I think that could have been largely avoided by educating people in advance. One issue with renewable energy projects is once you put a policy like this into place, it takes very little time from getting a project conceived and building it. It's much quicker than people are used to compared with many other types of development, like a nuclear plant. You know, it's a 10-year minimum horizon. And, you can have a wind tower up in 2 years. So I think the speed of it has been an issue for a lot of people. So there's been a definite lag with public understanding. And so a lot of my work in environmental defense has been trying to run education campaigns to explain there's so many things to explain how the technology works, how it actually does offset more polluting forms of generation on the grid, the fact that it is actually quite reliable when blended properly and mixed into the grid, to explain the economic opportunities presented by wind and solar, the many jobs created. We've had Ontario has had so far over 34 large manufacturers of renewable energy products open in Ontario. And I think there's at least 15 more promised to open. The big hiccup we've had has really been political, in that the governing Liberal Party we've had has been in for 2 terms, and they have been the champions of the program. And in an attempt to differentiate themselves, the Conservative Party and actually the left-leaning, we have another left-leaning party as well, have both been attacking this program politically. And we have an election coming up in October, and this has really sort of hampered the appetite for investors to get involved. People don't want to go through the long, expensive process of applying for a feed-in tariff project and then find out that the government's changed and the policy might be gutted. The Conservative Party has actually said we will stop accepting contracts if elected under the feed-in tariff program. So that for all of the success, which I can get to a bit more in detail, there's definitely some big political challenges we have to overcome. So the next month is actually going to be really critical for the program to see how it goes forward. Okay. In terms of how we've done on projects, we actually have two feed-in tariff programs. We have the FIT program, which is the larger commercial scale, and we have the MicroFIT program, which is mostly for rooftop solar projects that are 10 kilowatts or less, so roughly 40 panels or less.
Under the MicroFIT, is there anything but solar? Is it just for solar under the MicroFIT?
Technically, you could do a small wind installation, but if you crunch the numbers on that, it doesn't really make sense. So I think they said basically 99.9% of all projects under the MicroFIT are solar PV. And that program is designed to streamline the application process, so it should be very simple to apply. You basically check with your local utility, and they're actually legally obliged to connect you if they can. And once they've agreed to connect you, you can just sign up for the program. There's no down payment, essentially, and you can be connected within 6 to 8 months. So far, that program has been wildly successful, and they've had over 36,000 applications from individual homeowners and businesses to the program, and I think we've had over, I think it's around 5,000 of those actually now connected to the grid and producing. One issue we also had is one of the local utility, the major local utility that I mentioned before that was spun off, called Hydro One, which serves all of the rural areas of the province, has been, I think, reticent to hook up renewable energy projects. The distribution situation for them is much more complicated with all these small renewable energy projects, and they've been dragging their heels on connecting people. So they've been trying to argue to the government that they shouldn't have to connect a great deal of these. And we've heard that they've set an internal, completely arbitrary rule that they won't accept more than 7% of capacity on the grid in any one area of distributed projects like this. So they're trying desperately to not have to hook up these projects. But legally, the government mandates that they have to if there's room. So there's actually been a lot of political squabbling around how to resolve that issue.
Is that because they're worried about rate impacts locking themselves in with these 20-year contracts, or is it more they don't want to do the upgrades to the distribution system?
I think they don't want to do the upgrades. It makes their job much more difficult. The previous system of having very few generators and a very static, what I would call a very outdated style of grid, that's sort of a one-way, we make the electricity, you get it. Let's keep it simple.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's just sort of a cultural issue where this is still a very new idea of this smart distributed grid. And I think we've seen in Europe very high rates of these small level, particularly solar rooftop projects being installed and having very little impact on grid stability. And the new inverter technology, all these complicated technologies, basically mean that it's not really a risk to the grid at all to connect these projects, these small little projects. But the Hydro One has been saying things like, well, we could have islanding where what happens if the grid shuts down and this whole area is still electrified, or, you know, these things that are basically unfounded concerns, because the inverters will automatically adjust in those situations. So anyway, we've basically been sort of having a bit of a battle with some of the utilities. That said, some of the other utilities, like in Toronto here, City of Toronto owns its own distribution utility, and they've been very supportive, really excited about it, and have been very very helpful. So if you live in the Toronto area, getting a project connected under the microfit has been far easier. So I think that's something also to learn from. Make sure that the various distribution companies and that system is very clear, that the rules are very clear, and that everybody understands before you proceed with the law that they need to connect people, and, you know, here are the thresholds. Like, is it a 25% load from distributed sources? Like, you know, this needs to be fleshed out a bit more, because basically it feels like we're having a bit of an experiment on that front. That said, these programs have been very, very successful. I guess one other really big aspect is, I was mentioning before, the community level groups have been participating. They put in a big ask as part of our campaign to make sure that there was extra help to allow communities and public ownership of projects, because that's been proven to be a very big piece of why several of the European countries' renewable energy policies have been successful, particularly to get local buy-in. And so we have several granting programs through the OPA to help community groups get started on soft costs when developing their own projects. So getting hiring a consultant to get the project designed, and getting a co-op established or a share offering established, or those sorts of things. And so we don't have a huge amount of community power, but we definitely have a number of very, very, I would say, very cool examples of good community projects. So, for example, there's an Aboriginal community up north that is just building two full-scale wind towers, entirely 100% owned by their community. And so their community actually will get 100% of the profit from the wind towers. There are a number of small community organizations in different cities. Like we have a Boys and Girls Club in one city that's basically a community center. They put solar PV on their roof, and it's going to generate significant income to help maintain their activities down the line. There's actually a solar share offering for a number of commercial rooftops. This one group has put solar PV on a bunch of rooftops and is selling $1,000 shares to the public. So if you can't participate in the FIT program or the MicroFIT, you could at least buy a $1,000 share and still benefit from the program and still participate in some way. And we're actually pushing for an increase in the amount of community-level participation. I think that would be a serious antidote to some of the problems we've been having with wind power specifically. If communities were offered more options of ways to participate and to own and have control over projects in their communities, I think we would see a lot less backlash when the projects go in.
I think that's been a finding in Germany, as I think one of Paul Geib's articles addressed that, the local ownership mitigates public protest against siting, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a share in it, you're a lot less likely to protest its presence. Yep.
There's been quite a bit of academic literature done on this in the last while, and it's basically been proven to be a very effective way of getting communities excited about the projects as opposed to opposing them. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely something to consider, all of the options on that front. So those, I'm probably missing tons, sort of a basic overview of where we are. We have a huge amount of capacity. I think we're looking at the moment there's 3,500 megawatts nameplate capacity sort of nearing ready to be built. Not very many projects have actually been built yet, particularly the bulk of the megawatts is actually in wind, and there's a little bit longer lead time to build those projects. But they're just starting to be built now. And I think a huge percentage of those projects will actually get built in the next short while. And the government did actually sort of put in an extra rule into the program recently that basically protected all of the projects that are currently in the middle of applications from being shut down if the next government decides to get rid of the program. So it's close to safe to say that most of those projects I just mentioned, the 3,500, will go ahead regardless of politics in the next while. But the future of the program at large is very much in the balance up to the next election. So we're hoping that could be that goes well.
Yes.
So there's a number of other questions in here I'd like to get to. Did anybody have any burning questions they'd like to ask?
I have a bunch of questions.
Sure.
Who's this?
What are the permitting costs for under 10 kW and over 10 kW systems?
Under 10, a permit, the sort of all-in, basically you just pay a connection fee and an application fee, and I think total it's around $1,000. For over 10, it depends on the size of the project. They actually require you to put down a sizable down payment. I haven't gone through a FIT project myself. I think it's like a 5% of the total value of the project, kind of a down payment. Held against, so they don't want people just making arbitrary applications. So they actually require a significant amount of money sort of held in escrow during the application process to sort of show that you're serious and you actually plan to invest.
What is the rate impact?
The rate impact is pretty interesting. We actually did a pretty serious modeling. I can send that along out to Judy and have it sent to the larger group if you like.
Yeah, great.
The rate impact at the moment to date has been roughly 2% of electricity. Our what we call hydro bills here because we have a lot of hydroelectricity. Our electricity bills are roughly 2% renewable energy total, and that's mostly from stuff before the FIT program. So to date, there's been basically no impact.
Is there any mechanism in play to protect low-income folks?
No, that's an actually
from the rate impact.
But the modeling we've done shows that it's about $3 to $3.50 per month by 2018. That's the added cost of the feed-in tariff program.
What's the population of Ontario?
We're at, I think it's about 10 million.
I think the latest I saw was 13 million.
13 million, yeah. I always look at the latest. Okay. We're roughly a third the size of California. That's how I remember it. Yeah, 13 million.
Can I get
what
back
What was
to
your
you?
Reasoning? Be Are you guys allowing third party?
Third party.
Leasing.
Leasing. We are
leasing,
now.
Right.
The program, there was a bit of a hiccup there. A lot of leasing companies sort of jumped in there and tried to scoop up a ton of the projects. Mm-hmm. And so they created a separate rule for leasers. But, yes, we do allow leasing programs now. So they just basically get a lower tariff.
Ah, okay. And what's
it's a new it's a new rule. We've been sort of adapting this policy over time as issues
right.
come up, and that's the most one of the most recent ones they've dealt with is
and
commercial
you know,
rooftop leasing. But yes,
okay,
there are a number of companies offering that now.
Okay, so there's and they receive a lower tariff. Why?
Well, it's because they're able to aggregate. It's complicated, but basically you're only allowed one FIT project per rooftop, so that's fine. But if you're doing microfit, like the smaller scale ones, which is what a lot of the leasing business is in,
mm-hmm.
it basically goes against the rule. So they created a new rule to allow it under certain rules. It's quite complicated. I don't have all the details in front of me, but I know that they are allowing commercial rooftop leasing, and it should be fully profitable. And so I've talked
My
to
final
it.
Question is, and I really thank everybody for indulging me, is I'm wonder what the thought process was between just I understand you wanting to bring more labor and more manufacturing to Ontario, but at the same time, you know, I carry these great name brand panels that I would not be able to install in Ontario. What are your thoughts about that?
It's a difficult one. I do think, given where we are politically in terms of getting I feel personally renewable energy is incredibly important that we get this going. And if it takes some of these things to get political buy-in from the population or from the government, I think it's very worthwhile. The program is interesting because, you know, for something like solar PV, for example, we've now attracted most of the major nameplate manufacturers of solar. They're going through a local manufacturer. So they just have to set up either the silicon or the panel itself needs to be made here. So they can, you have a choice. And, you know, actually creating a local manufacturer isn't, it's obviously difficult, but if you offer them a big enough market, it's not too difficult to attract them. So I think we've sort of actually proved that companies will come if you can set this up. And it's been very, very important to the program in Ontario. I'm not sure we would be anywhere close to where we were without some sort of domestic content rule.
What is the price per watt installed of a system under 10 kW generally?
I don't know at the moment. I'm sorry, I don't have that information. I can find out these questions. If you want to put those to me in an email, I can get that information for you.
I'm jotting them down, and I will. And
yeah, that would be great.
Andrew,
I have contacts who can get that information to me, but the price has been coming down significantly, and that's why I'm not sure what the latest is.
Adam, the political opposition that you're encountering, is it based on ratepayer impact, or what is the thrust of the political opposition?
So the microfit program, the highest possible tariff, and it's only for a very tiny fraction of total megawatts, so it's actually a drop in the bucket in real terms, but it appears terrible, is 80 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's what you're paid if you set up a microfit at the moment on a rooftop solar. And to most people, that just seems outrageous. They don't understand the reasoning behind the program. They don't understand spot prices for electricity during peak times, all of the complex stuff that goes behind this. And so it's been very easy we've had some conservative politicians saying, that's, you know, the average averaged rate for electricity in Ontario is 5 5 cents a kilowatt hour, how can you justify paying 80? And electricity prices have gone up significantly in Ontario in the past, since deregulation, essentially, because our prices were held artificially low by our public system for many years. And even during the regulation process, electricity rates were government-subsidized to keep them down. And so we've had quite a spike in electricity rates, which has nothing to do with renewable energy at all. We've been refurbishing our nuclear power plants and upgrading our transmission and all these other projects. So they've taken advantage of the seemingly outrageous tariffs as an example of why your electricity rates are going on. So if you see a number of politicians around Ontario right now, because we're facing an election, are saying, we'll cancel these dangerous energy experiments that are causing your hydro bills to skyrocket. But if you do the economic modeling and you understand that very few projects or very few megawatts of projects are actually getting that rate, the bulk of it is the wind tariff, which is 13.5 cents. The 13.5 cents per kilowatt hour for wind is actually all in much lower than it would be for any new nuclear or even some of the natural gas we're installing when you consider all the costs in. So it's basically it's a political thing. It's not really based in reality. We actually modeled two scenarios, one where we keep the act as is, as it's planned with the current pipeline, compared to if we were to scrap the act and make up the difference with natural gas. And we basically calculated that in the next 10 years, if we got rid of the act, we would save about 1% to 2% on our hydro bills averaged per year. But in the long run, over 20 years, it's quite likely we would lose money because natural gas prices are expected to increase over time. And renewable energy will actually save us money in the very long term. So the impact on rates is really not very significant.
Two questions on that I'd like to load, because this is our main challenge at the
mm-hmm.
moment is rate impact,
yeah.
as you can see by the
by
whole
the
low
questions.
Income protection. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So how you're modeling, how far in the future did it go that you can project increases in natural gas prices? Do you know how
well, obviously
long?
There's a lot of uncertainty around that modeling. It's quite a complex
yeah.
model.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they probably did several runs at it and averaged them. But I think they did a 20-year outlook.
Okay.
We hired an independent energy modeling company.
Was that
actually another organization? If you can look it up yourself if you want to, right after, an organization called the Pembina Institute in Canada commissioned. We work with them often. They commissioned this study.
PEM.
You can find it on their website.
What's their name again?
Pembina
Institute.
Okay. Okay. This is
if you type
connected.
In the Pembina Institute Ontario Energy, you'll probably find their
okay.
study.
Is this connected to the impact report done by Clear Sky, or is that separate?
No, that's independent. That's separate.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The Clear Sky models were largely about job creation.
Oh, okay.
And the cost associated with that. So there was one. Clear Sky did one for the solar industry and one for the wind industry.
Okay. I think we were just told they've just completed one on the rate impact.
Oh, they have. Well, they haven't released it yet.
It's just been released. I think we just got the email from Tim Volgamut yesterday. Kathleen did.
Really?
Yesterday.
Okay, because
anyway,
that
yeah.
hasn't come out publicly
yes.
in Ontario yet.
No. He's
and I usually get Tim.
Yeah.
Tim will usually email that to me.
Oh, okay. Anyway,
but
it's very
I know that they
anyway.
were working on one, but I they told me we don't know exactly what
okay.
our release strategy is.
Okay. Yeah. One of the supporters wanted to hold it up for public release to be at the right timing. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're hoping to get him on a future call to talk about that because
oh,
rate
excellent.
Impact is the issue we need to understand most. It's the area that we have the most difficulty in addressing what rate impact would be. So can I ask you? You said the rate impact is negligible. How is that? I understand from Tim actually that they did compare you in Ontario. As I understand, you're going to have to replace a lot of your current.
Yeah,
generation.
And that's why it's very
okay.
it's very jurisdiction
dependent.
Based. If it
okay.
may be very different where you are, but in Ontario,
okay.
we neglected new generation capacity, and we neglected
mm-hmm.
our transmission and distribution system pretty severely for a number of years because of the public system and the difficulty of deregulation. So we're in a position now where we have to replace our generation regardless. We have very outdated old nuclear power plants that need refurbishment. We're getting rid of coal. It's just become politically a no-go for any party in Ontario to remain having coal. And so, you know, there's just no way getting around that. And so, you know, the cheapest option is actually conservation by far. The conservation is sort of written into our legislation, but we haven't done enough yet. But basically we're able to compare the cost of these renewable energy technologies when compared to new generation in other forms that are not coal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in Ontario, renewable energy compares quite favorably to those. One of the big pushes this act got actually was the Ontario government has been in the process of looking at getting a new nuclear reactor, or it's actually several new nuclear reactors built in the next 10 years. And they actually got bids from a number of the nuclear companies. And the only bid that ended up being successful came through at $25 billion for two reactors. I think they were 600 megawatt reactors each or something quite small. And we've had a history of cost overruns on our nuclear builds beyond, you know, we've had some that have been 2.5 times the original quoted price.
Right.
And so basically we just got sticker shock. The energy minister at the time was, you know, in the middle of this process designing this renewable energy policy, mm-hmm. and then looking at the actual cost of nuclear and they said we can't accept that bid. We cannot, that's far too much money and there's no certainty that we won't face huge penalties in the future. So it's in the context of other generation that we're able to say it's really not going to change the cost picture for consumers. Electricity prices are going up one way or another in Ontario. It's not to do with renewable energy.
So when you say that the rate impact was negligible, is that in comparison to what it would have cost to replace your current fossil fuel generation or to replace nuclear? Or is it for actual current rates? The impact on actual current rates has been negligible.
Well, on current rates, I mean, the program, only being 2 years old, hasn't actually seen a huge volume of projects installed. We have quite a few, but the current projects installed have had a negligible impact for sure.
Okay.
In the future, there will be, obviously, with high tariffs like that, there will be some impact. You have to definitely calculate what that is. I would, you know, be very careful and overestimate what those impacts might be. I think that's a very intelligent thing to do.
Yes, because we've seen coming out is this reference to a Tim Hortons donut, which is about $1, which seems extremely low.
Yeah, but now sort of, you know, the 2018 projection we've come up with sort of says a coffee and a donut per month.
Because by that time, this is how much will have been installed? You want to install it all?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so it won't all be installed.
Yeah.
Once it's all installed, is there a modeling of that?
That's roughly that increase that we're looking at.
Okay.
For us, you know, if you're looking at the increases we're expecting every year in increases of energy, you're looking at like a quarter or less of that increase would be from renewable energy.
Yeah.
And we're doing quite a significant amount of renewable energy.
Okay.
Well, it's also expected that the tariffs will come down. I mean, this year we're going to review them and lower the solar and wind tariffs both, quite likely.
Mm-hmm.
And the ramping down over time is very intentional. It's interesting. A lot of opponents of renewable energy have referred back to Europe and said, well, they're lowering their tariffs. Clearly they don't think this is a worthwhile enterprise. And it's like, oh, so frustrating to me because, you know.
They don't understand.
That's what a good tariff
does. It's
designed
to bring down the costs. Exactly. Yeah.
If a successful feed-in tariff program over time should make itself obsolete.
Yes.
You have installed costs come way down. You don't need the tariff anymore.
Right.
And that's the goal. We're not trying to arbitrarily subsidize here. We actually believe that long-term, something like solar PV will be very competitive.
Right. But there has to be a market for it for those costs to come down. So may I just ask one question? What is the total installation capacity you expect by the end of, is it 2018? Does the program end?
No, it's a bit complicated. The OPA has created what they call the long-term energy plan, which is their sort of projection for what they're seeking in to add to the grid, and it goes to 2018. And they haven't published what they want after that. So at the moment, they haven't said what they want to add after 2018, but by 2018, where I think they're expecting in somewhere between 6 and 8,000 megawatts of nameplate renewable energy capacity could be added.
Okay, 6,000 megawatts of nameplate.
Yeah, I can show you that, but it's
thank you.
It's pretty substantial.
Oh yes. Thank you. That's
one awesome. Question that I saw in here was sort of, will the entire $9 billion in capital investment? I'm assuming, I'm not sure if they mean solar, wind, or if they mean all technologies combined. But $9 billion
that
in capital that's be paid back out of electricity rates.
Yes, because this is the figure that we're seeing as to the private investment capital that's been attracted by the program.
$9 billion would be.
That's for all renewables. I know. We do know that.
Okay, because the current estimate is that the market size is roughly $30 billion.
Okay.
it's quite complicated. That's all technologies combined.
Okay. So in the what we've been quoting is the first year's results from Clear Sky report that we got.
Either way,
so
the answer is yes.
So over
the program
time,
only subsidizes through rates.
So over time, you expect the total cost of 6,000 megawatts to be $30 billion? Is that what you made, the total market?
I'd have to look and see if that number lines up with – this is the total market size. I calculated a rough guess of the current projects that are in the pipeline, not built, but potentially being built, and it was over $20 billion.
Okay.
The multiplier, you know, which multiplier you use –
Could
change that number considerably.
Okay.
Like the actual cost per installed megawatt, but it's
but
fair
to
say
that. But then the cost of the ratepayers is higher than that, right, because of the FIT.
Yeah.
Because of the return on investment.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Sure.
This is Sybil Gieselman. I was wondering about the financing on the micro-FIT. I was trying to build a rate setting model, and I realized, you know, generally I assume that the 7-11% return is assuming that those people are going to have to get some loans to be able to make this big investment, and then they'll have to pay some interest on the loan. So
mm-hmm.
maybe that I assume that 11% is after or is that high so that it's helping to cover their interest, but
you get
is that correct?
I'd say it's unlikely at the moment. If you got a loan, you would be able to get an 11% return. That would be difficult.
Right. Yeah, that's okay.
So you fall
on
the lower end
of
that range. But yes, yeah, I think
yeah.
you know there's
and so in terms of cash flow though, are people I mean generally I don't think that you'd be able to get a 20-year loan to even out your cash flow. So say you had a 10-year loan and you were having to pay back your project over 10 years, but you're getting your return rate based on a 20-year life. So does that mean that people have a negative cash flow for the first 10 years and then the final 10 years they're getting paid after they've paid off their investment?
That's generally true.
Okay.
I have seen some loan programs at higher interest rates, obviously, actually let you do that because the guaranteed rate that they will actually give you the loan over the life of the project.
Okay.
So they will. That is actually a product that exists that will let you do that. So you can actually start taking profit early if you want. Of course, you lose, you know, in the long term, a significant chunk of your investment to the interest rate. But a lot of people, the average payback would be between 8 and 10 years for a solar PV rooftop.
Okay.
And then you get the profit.
Depending on the install,
that.
You know, your installer and all sorts of other little details. But basically, yeah, I'd say 8 to 10-year payback. So that's a fair assessment.
Okay. And you said there are 20-year products, loan products?
Yeah. You might have to qualify, but yeah. The major, it took a while. This is one of the biggest pieces of this as well. Is it's all great to have this. we put the policy out first, and then You wait for manufacturing to arrive. You wait for installers to actually learn how to install systems. You wait for the investment community. And the investment slash finance part of it has been slow, but definitely getting into it now. And it's definitely a big, if you want to have the community energy part of it in particular, there's actually still a gap in debt and in investment for that part. So it's been really a long process of getting the investment community to realize the value of these projects and seeing them as safe investments, which is now coming finally.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Seeing them as safe investments.
If you're looking to involve stakeholders, you know, in a coalition, I would look into some more progressive-minded investments.
When you
folks
encounter the politicians who complain about the outrageously high tariffs in the microfit, what are your most persuasive counterarguments? Is it the increase in employment or the general investment and economic boom, or what are your best tools to counter those complaints?
Definitely, I'd say definitely one of the biggest, we've tested a couple of different messages, and definitely the jobs angle is a good one. But, you know, obviously in a lot of people's mind, that doesn't counteract, well, you're paying a lot for your electricity, but you're getting some jobs out of it. Doesn't always work. So it's actually been a real challenge to try to counteract that microfit. The biggest argument is generally like, well, that's just, you're not really telling the truth there, because most projects aren't getting 80 cents. They're getting, you know, the opposition has been going out of their way to confuse people. So a lot of people will say, oh, well, this wind project going in my backyard getting 80 cents, that's outrageous.
Oh, but they aren't, yes.
I've actually had difficulty in counteracting that message. It's been one of the reasons why they're, you know, I don't think we were fully prepared for a political attack on the program. That's something you want to look at.
Yeah.
I think educating people about the fact that a lot of people in Ontario still don't know that the microfit program exists.
Right.
I keep running into people and saying, you know, you can put solar on your roof, connect it to the grid, and make income. Mm-hmm. Like, really? Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So that's something that needs to go along with any successful, you know, program. Is just basic explaining
education.
The program, explaining that it exists,
okay,
explaining why.
What are your utility rates per kilowatt hour?
We now have time of use pricing, so it's between 6 and 9 cents a kilowatt hour. And then that's less than half your bill, so you pay another, you know, you pay more than double that on the actual bill for distribution and transmission.
How about the smart meter issue that's emerged with the work of Dr. Magda Havas up in Trent University in Ontario and the worldwide popular uprising against the issues like fires, overages and bills, and the health effects of non-ionized radiation?
There's a couple of different questions in there. You mean, you said something about smart meters first, and then?
Yeah, the smart meters are being installed, what, 4 million in California and
oh,
a million
yeah, the,
in Oregon.
Sorry, the remote smart meter system. Yeah, people have, it seems to be a pretty small issue still. There's a couple people who are really upset about it. I haven't.
I don't think you've done research in the last couple months. I'm in communication with realtors at Fine Homes Realty in Marin, and I just talked to Dr. Carl Moret today from the Dove Health Alliance, and there's Rob States, MIT-educated engineer. I have about 15 or 20 people here in Eugene who are engineers and scientists and trained in LCC energy management who have come up with
it. But in Ontario,
I wouldn't contradict
yet.
Any of the science. I don't know about that issue very much. I'm just saying it's not on the public radar here in terms
of
an issue.
Oh, it's not on the public radar. Actually, one of the schools just shut down cell phones or Wi-Fi in the schools. It is a public issue. And if I can get your email after I'm done with my eWeb presentation today, I can send you some information about.
Sure, no, I totally agree. It's an issue, but it doesn't relate to on the smart meter issue in Ontario. It's you know, maybe it's a much larger discussion about Wi-Fi and
cell
phones in general. I definitely agree that it's a real issue. I'm not. I'm just saying it doesn't relate really to feed-in tariffs or to our smart meter program.
Oh, it doesn't. Okay, that's good to know. Yeah.
Any anyone else have any contracts? Excuse me, not contracts. Questions? I wasn't able to answer some of your more
specific number questions because it's just so many involved.
Yes.
A program like this. I did print out the latest. You can get the biweekly reports.
Okay.
If you go, if you type in Ontario OPA FIT, F-I-T, you'll find a website. You can get biweekly reports. They put them out every 2 weeks.
Okay.
And they include the latest breakdown of all the projects that are in the pipeline. So you can see how many applications have been made in every category, how many megawatts, how many are installed, how many are going to be. It's all there.
Could I ask you one other category of question before we go? And
sure.
I'm keeping you over a few minutes. We are also trying to get this policy in place against a backdrop of other policies that have been used, like tax credits, business depreciation, property tax credits, incentives. And do you did you face that? I mean, what were the incentives in place? Do you have anything like that?
Well,
and
that
do
was
you still have them?
That's why I sort of gave that background, was that Ontario, we tried a net metering program, which sounds nice in practice, but didn't really do anything, didn't really generate any interest.
So how was it funded? Were people able to get the upfront money to put the system up?
There was no financing.
There wasn't
because
we have in this kind of widely in the U.S. and certainly in Oregon, energy tax credits, which means you get a rebate on your taxes, whether it's state or federal, to help cover the cost of putting the systems up. So you haven't had any.
No, we've
that's
never
not
done that tax
used
system
in
Ontario.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Okay.
Everything I've read has sort of suggested that that's a less effective policy in terms of dollars spent on projects and in terms of getting projects built quickly.
Yep. But it's politically.
I'm sure you probably better read on that than I am. But,
well, it's politically easy to sell because it, you know, for those, it means less revenue. Government's collecting revenue, which was politically a very popular argument on the right. So, and business depreciation for renewable energy, is there anything like that? It's another form of reduced taxes. Okay, that helps us to know that. Thank you.
Does the provincial government or any of the local governments have a low-interest loan program to subsidize these projects, or is it all private capital from which people are getting their loans?
There isn't really a program. No, there's a program for Aboriginal groups. So we have, you know, a reserve system, and there are many Aboriginal communities. So there's actually a separate guaranteed loan program for them. So there is that. But other than that, no, they expect all projects to basically go on their own with private capital. It's actually an interesting, you know, if you want to, from a political perspective, it's kind of easy to message around. Basically, we're arguing you should pay the full cost of electricity, not this subsidized fake cost that that we've been paying for a long time. It's a tough pill to swallow, but we've been paying artificially low prices for a long time. And when you compare your various the various technologies side by side with actual costs revealed, we found that that the problem we were having is that the feed-in tariff rates are being compared to fake numbers. So they compare it to the cost of electricity from a 30 or 40-year-old plant that's already been paid off.
So what does new
generation compare? How does it compare to your technologies? That's an important thing.
Yes, we've run across that. We need apples to apples comparisons, not apples to oranges comparisons.
That's a great it's a great messaging track if you're looking at that. Also,
with respect to the low income segment of the population, your basic response is it just doesn't really cost that much. We're not making special provisions for low income citizens. We're just saying it doesn't cost that much.
Yeah, that is the position at the moment. That's not to say that I don't think a low-income piece could be added to the project. Actually, I think as we do reviews down the line and the cost goes up, there may well be room for something like that, and that may be something you'd like to look into. I've actually been contacted by a number of groups interested in, is there a low-income angle to this?
Is there any targeted weatherization or conservation program for those people?
There is at the moment, but it's basically our federal government has allowed its audit program to collapse. They've just not put any more money into it. It's an audit and retrofitting, and the provincial government's followed. So we're in this dead zone of conservation at the moment. But I expect their long-term plan in Ontario calls for a significant new program on that front. So, yeah, we should have home retrofit program back up and running in the next while. If the election goes one way, and if it doesn't, then we won't. But yeah.
Yes, and one final question that talks way into the future. Sybil, I know you wanted to know the answer to this question. What happens at the end of the contracts?
Thanks.
Yeah, well, that's we don't. It's not actually written down anywhere, and nobody's, you know, said anything. And I can say for one thing for certain is that the government in place won't be the same one when the contracts are over. It's an interesting question. I think there probably will be, since everything's already connected and metered, and it's quite likely that there will be some sort of extension granted in some capacity. I just don't know what it will be. And we also don't know what the electricity situation will be at the end of the 20-year contracts.
So would the producers...
We may be much closer to cost parity,
uh-huh.
and the subsidy may not be needed in the same way.
They may just be paid the going rate at the time for energy.
Particularly for the wind projects. I mean, they're already not very far from cost parity.
Mm-hmm.
The solar may be a little bit further away, but my own family, we have put up a microfit program or a project.
Uh-huh.
My parents, my older brother actually designs the systems, and it's you get a 25-year warranty on your solar panel, and you get a 20-year guaranteed government contract. So the panels will outlast the contract for sure. So we've been wondering what we would do with ours after we might.
Have you ever heard the argument from, say, renters who say, why should I pay to give local homeowners free energy? Why should I, if I can't participate in the program, why should I pay extra on my bill so that someone else, when they're to pay off someone else's system, that will give them free energy?
That's a good point. I mean, anybody could be a producer, even those who are renters, just maybe not on your own building. We want to make sure there are opportunities in Ontario right now to invest in FIT programs FIT projects that aren't on your own house. So the microfit's just one option, and that's why these community programs are important.
Yes. Okay.
So we're definitely like that solar share I mentioned. You can buy a $1,000 share in a solar project and receive investment. So it's not really about homeowners don't automatically get solar systems. They have to invest considerable.
Yes.
Capital, and then that's available to anybody, whether or not you live on a house or not.
Yes.
Also, municipal governments are now investing as well because a lot of them own their own utilities.
Okay.
And so there's definitely several municipalities that have put a ton of solar up on the roof, and they're taking the income directly back into municipal revenue and using it to offset taxes. So you can actually lower your property taxes as a result.
Yeah, I think the challenge for us is the modeling. I'll be very interested to see your modeling because we're getting such fear that this is going to impact rates just enormously. The rate impact is going to be overwhelming, and we need to, protect everybody from it. So these are the unknowns for us. So I think we need more modeling on what the impact of this type of a program would be. And as you say, our pilot project to test the concept, which is a very flawed test of the concept anyway, but it's on solar, which is the most expensive. So everyone is projecting.
Yeah, your results are going to be a bit skewed.
Solar. Yeah.
It's about the overall mix. One thing I didn't actually address, and I realize I probably should have earlier, is that one other big cost factor in Ontario is we have quite a large peak to base jump, like most places do. So the background base in Ontario is 13,000 megawatts, and the peak load would be about 26,000 megawatts. And so the new capacity we need really is only there to address the peak load. And when we're nearing peak, we have sort of all of our most expensive technologies, all of our most expensive generators up and running. And so stuff like solar, while it may seem expensive, is in Ontario anyway, is very ideally suited to our demand curve during the day. So it produces the maximum power when power is most expensive in Ontario.
Okay.
And does not produce at night when power is very cheap. And so you can look at the averages, and it's not doesn't tell the whole story, but the spot prices for electricity during the day can sometimes get quite high. And compared to the tariff, it's not really that outrageous. And that may be one of the reasons why adding solar PV doesn't impact rates in the way that you think it might.
How does the time of day pricing get adopted up there if you didn't have the smart meters and the control from the utility?
Well, that's on the consumer side, but it's averaged into the price of the energy at the moment right now.
So
on the distribution side, that's where we don't pay spot prices as consumers.
No.
We pay an averaged price, and that's why it's important.
It reflects the impact on the rate payer.
System operators will have to turn on very expensive power sources at peak times during the day.
Or
import power from the United States sometimes, which happens.
Yes. So if I could follow up on that, what you want to look at is the baseload demand compared to your peak demand during the day. And the bigger the difference, the more economical solar becomes.
Well, what we've discovered in Ontario is that this is actually an interesting argument for conservation as well. We have a peak shaver program. We can actually remotely turn off industrial users of power who sign up for the program during times of peak load, and that's far cheaper than generating that electricity.
Right.
And this, this is the same with solar specifically. Solar is very good at reducing peak if we have a high amount of installed solar. And I know that your question mentioned that may be an issue on the West Coast. When you have a lot of hydroelectric, the base for your system.
Yeah.
So the circumstances may well be different there.
Mostly winter peaking out here, so we're worried about that day in December when there's very short daylight hours and very little sun to meet those extreme peaks, which, solar PV doesn't quite help in that situation.
Yeah. That's why I think, In total, percentages, our solar PV will be from a quarter to a third of the renewable energy we're adding. Most of it will be wind.
Mm-hmm.
And the wind actually does generate more electricity in the wintertime. And I imagine that would be more true where you are. I don't know if you're considering
wind.
It
depends on the weather patterns that are going through.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
A lot of time when there's, multi-day cold spells where there's no pressure differences, the wind will just die down. And I think there was a time period in January of 2009 where there was no wind for multiple days during very peak.
During peak load.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in Ontario, we have a large geographic area, like as you do. We've spread out loads, and definitely the wind produces significantly more in the winter months than it does in the summer.
Which is one, and Sybil's talking from the perspective of a small geographical area covered by a consumer-owned utility within the larger state of Oregon, most of whose population is served by several investor-owned utilities. So what we've been talking about is the advantage of having a statewide feed-in tariff that would be participated in by all utilities. But how you organize that with investor-owned utilities and consumer-owned utilities, where you house the program, how that would work is new territory. And as I've seen the recent UCLA report, looking at in there's only two states that have done it, and that's Vermont. One of them is Vermont, which they looked at North America, and Ontario and Vermont are the only provincial or state jurisdictions to do this. And you have this, Vermont has a public agency that procures power and sells it to the utilities. So what they've done is they're the procurement, so they sign the contracts. That agency signed the contracts with the new producers, the wind, whatever. And in Ontario, would you characterize the OPA as a procurement agency?
Yes.
Okay, but they're both public agencies.
They manage the contracts. They make the decisions on what kind of generation they want, and they procure it.
So in Oregon, we don't have such an entity. And so it's going to be a new ball of wax.
But you know what's interesting? Our OPA, though, wasn't created for the purpose of renewable energy. So it was a very small, it was a 20-person office back in 2004. And it was basically designed with doing studies, modeling studies on the future of the energy system and working out how much capacity we need to add and all of these, you know, complex future decisions. So they would release reports on what we need to be doing to maintain our system.
So did they have to beef up their this is another issue that's come up here, and I saw this reflected in the UCLA report, is that how do you decide if you want to emphasize economic development and inclusiveness, different lots of varied sizes of projects, and you have an agency which is who's going to manage it, and how do they have the competencies to do that? So you're saying OPA started out mostly as a research agency, and now they're operating this quite extensive program to create jobs and
and quite a bit of political direction behind them. They're now a 300 or 400 person operation, managing contracts through a pipeline.
They've
grown into the program very very quickly. So it's, you know, you could almost say that it was a new agency almost created.
Okay.
The way that the mandate of the agency changed, because before there were so few actual generation. There was one Crown Corporation that owned all the generation, and the OPA would just sort of say, go put on another nuclear plant. Very simple decision making that way.
Right.
But we're talking about, 10,000 individual projects.
Yes.
You need a serious bureaucracy to handle that. And I think there's been a massive learning curve over the OPA. In terms of getting, ramping up and getting, and they're actually getting quite a bit better at it now in the last while. Quite a few complaints early on in the program that they weren't able to handle this.
Okay. You wanted to say anything else?
No, I think I'm okay. Unless, does anyone have any more questions? I know you probably, it's been over time. So.
I have a burning question. This is Kim. I was reflecting back on my notes. You talked about the introduction of acceptance of the lease programs into the microfit program. Did you say that you did know or didn't know how much less those rates were?
How much less?
The reduction in the rates. The tariff.
In the tariff, feed-in tariff rates for microfit producers who also are participating in the lease programs.
In the waste program. Oh, the reduction.
The leasing program.
I'm sorry.
You said that to incorporate it in. They weren't in the beginning. Now they have been, but the rates are lower.
Yeah, they've come back and clarified the policy on lease on commercial. They call them commercial aggregators.
Okay.
That's the lingo used. You're best to go to the site yourself and see if you can take a look and figure it out, because they've published a schedule. It's quite complicated.
Okay.
If you can find the Ontario Power Authority feed-in tariff site, which is pretty easy to find on Google.
Yes, and that would probably be a very recent bulletin. I go up to it periodically.
They'll post a bulletin. New rules for aggregators was something
new rules
that
for
happened
aggregators.
About 2 months
okay.
ago.
Okay, great. Thank you.
No problem.
Great. So I want to thank you so much, Adam. Anyone have any more closing questions for Adam? He's been very indulgent with us. If not, then we'll thank you very much. This has been real education, and we actually are trying to line someone up to from Clear Sky, and I think that may happen at the end of the month. I think Tim may be able to join us to talk about rate impact and some more details of what they're finding. But you've been an enormous font of information, Adam. So.
Yeah, and I just want to remind you what Dennis Hayes said at the University of Oregon last year, the former director of the Solar Energy Research Institute, president of the Board Foundation, that solar energy will be the major energy source of the world within his children, and he's about 70 years old. So I think we're looking toward the solar alternative, but the distributed generation is being held up, I think, by the private utilities, also the publicly owned utilities in this country. And I want to remind you to look at the website smallisprofitable.org by Rocky Mountain Institute that looks at 207 reasons why it benefits utilities to be distributed. It's Edison's vision only a century late is what they point out.
Excellent.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful note to end on.
Great.
Thank you, everyone.
Hi, everyone. See you next time.
Talk to you. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks again,
Thank
Adam.
You.
Right, no
Bye-bye.
Thank you
Bye.
For answering my question.
Bye, Sybil.
Bye.